Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll have a conversation about the effects of the natural gas drilling technique known as fracking. Dozens of homeowners in the U.S. say that because of it, they can now light their well water on fire. But first, a federal court in New Orleans hears arguments today for and against the temporary moratorium on exploratory deepwater drilling in the Gulf. The government says the moratorium is necessary while it evaluates the industry's safety procedures, but also because a second mishap in the Gulf would overwhelm responders. But the companies suing to overturn the ban say the government has no evidence that existing rigs are unsafe, and the moratorium is costing hundreds of millions of dollars in lost wages every week. So what is going on in the Gulf? Stephen Mufsum is energy and finance reporter for The Washington Post. Stephen, we know the moratorium is only on exploratory deep water rigs. There are 33 of them. That still leaves what? Tell us about the rigs that are active in the Gulf.
Well, there are still a lot of rigs active in water that's more shallow than 500 feet deep, and there are thousands of production platforms pumping oil all the time in the Gulf.
And by production platform, you mean as opposed to these exploratory rigs. These are platforms that are already pumping, yeah.
Right. These 33 rigs in deep water that are directly affected were exploration well rigs, and they were drilling into new rock and trying to search for new oil and gas reservoirs.
Well, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal and State Attorney General Buddy Caldwell are part of this move to ask the judge to lift this six-month moratorium on this exploratory drilling. The two main arguments are that it will devastate the local economy, but also have a long-term effect because we know these exploratory drilling rigs can get up and move to other places. They just can't sit idle. But how do you reconcile those claims with the fact that those are just 33 exploratory rigs and there are, we understand, thousands of these platforms pumping in the Gulf?
Yeah, well, there are thousands of platforms pumping. Some of them are unmanned. So, you know, there is, a lot of things are happening here. On the one hand, you do have a lot of platforms. The oil and gas business is much bigger than just the 33 deep water exploration wells, and that business will continue. However, there are thousands of jobs associated with these deep water exploration rigs. A lot of them are among the best paying jobs. Some of those rigs are already starting to move out to other countries that have deep water exploration programs, like Brazil. So I think the fear is real there, and the anxiety and the impact is real there in the Gulf. It's not to say that the oil and gas business is going to vanish from the Gulf, but, you know, there are some jobs, definitely some jobs and some good-paying jobs at stake there right now.
Well, you say 5,000 to 10,000 workers will be affected by this moratorium. 6 months is a pretty good chunk of time, but what? What is the other side arguing? Will those jobs come back or those rigs come back?
Well, that's the other thing, is I think inevitably we're going to have to come back to these rigs because that's where the best oil prospects are in the United States. So I think, in my guess, and it's just a guess, my guess is that the administration will think about this and will come up with new safety precautions to take, but that ultimately we're going to go back into these areas because that's you know, we're still going to, even if we cut our oil consumption by quite substantially, we're still going to end up needing a lot of this oil, I think.
Well, meanwhile, Steve, one last question. The government is sending people to every exploratory rig, figuring out these new safety standards. We understand through the hearings that all the oil companies, not just BP, had the same terribly inept response plans, so there's great concern. This morning, the New York Times is reporting that Transocean, which owned the rig that blew, commissioned a strictly confidential study of the reliability of blowout preventers and found a nearly 50% failure rate. That doesn't, with that kind of information, a judge considering that kind of information, doesn't that seem that the administration might lean towards waiting to check them out?
Absolutely. I think that's the kind of thing they want to look more closely at. And one of the points that I think they'll look at is whether to require more duplication, more redundancy on these blowout preventers to make sure that they so-called fail-safe option doesn't fail.
That's Steve Mufson, energy and finance reporter for The Washington Post, helping us check in on today's hearings and the activity that is going on in the Gulf. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That gusher in the Gulf isn't just spewing oil. It's spewing vast amounts of natural gas, which scientists at Texas A&M say will create huge oxygen-depleted dead zones. Now, many American homeowners say natural gas drilling rigs on land have already polluted their water sources, made their animals and their children sick, and allowed them to perform the neat but scary parlor trick, holding up a lighter to water from a running faucet and watching it explode into flame.
Whoa, Jesus Christ.
That's the best I've got. I smell hair.
Oh, damn.
Oh, well, pardon the language, but what happened was they held a lighter to a faucet and it exploded into a flame. How can this be? Filmmaker Josh Fox of Milanville, Pennsylvania, wanted to find out. Like other homeowners, he received a letter from a mining company informing him that his land was on the valuable Marcellus Shale. They offered him $100,000 to drill on his land to get at the natural gas trapped in the rock. But Josh's beloved Calkins Creek was on the land, and he'd heard stories about exploding faucets, so he set out with his camera, and the resulting documentary, Gasland, begins airing tonight on HBO. It won the Documentary Special Jury Prize at the 2010 Sundance Film Festival, and Josh Fox joins us from the NPR studios in New York with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, overall, you found not just homeowners, but whistleblowers. You found out that there were Bush-era exemptions in the Clean Water Act that allowed companies to pollute water. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's learn a little bit more about how natural gas is actually drilled. It's a technique called fracking.
Yeah, it's called hydraulic fracturing. And you're right. I mean, it was utterly, nothing really could prepare me for the series of shocks that happened as I was making this film. I live on the Marcellus Shale, which is 50% of New York, 65% of Pennsylvania, half of Ohio, and pretty much all of West Virginia and parts of Virginia. And there's this new technique called hydraulic fracturing. Fracking itself isn't so new, but the way that they're doing it now is new. They drill down into this shale formation, which is about 8,000 feet down, and they actually fracture the rock using enormous pressure of water and chemicals injected into that substrata. 2 to 7 million gallons of fluid, which is water laced with this chemical toxic cocktail called fracking fluid. And in the fracking fluid, there can be up to 596 different chemical additives, and most of those are toxic. So they fracture the rock with this fracking fluid at huge high pressure, 9,000 pounds per square inch, about 1,000 gallons a minute, and it breaks the rock apart, frees up the gas. Most of that toxic fluid gets left in the ground. About 75 to 50% of it actually gets left in the ground. And as you said, I found out, the Safe Drinking Water Act monitors underground injection of toxins. And the hydraulic fracture and the natural gas drilling industry lobbied very hard, along with Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force, to get this process. This sort of, it's called the Halliburton loophole. They got exempted from the Safe Drinking Water Act in 2005. They're also exempt from the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Superfund Act. So when you take all those things together, they are now allowed to pollute, and that's what's been going on, and it's been going on with impunity.
Well, and it's not just this huge amount of water, millions and millions of gallons of water, you know, never mind the trucks that have to drive over people's property to bring this water in to do this kind of fracking technique. But the huge portion stays underground. It can become integrated with our underground water systems. But a huge amount of this toxic water is also brought back above land, and then it evaporates. It becomes a part of our ecosystem.
Yeah. The part of the fluid that they recover, they have a really hard time dispersing of. Fracking fluid is the most toxic liquid material in the United States. There are no water treatment facilities that want to accept it. So what the industry is allowed to do is put it in pits, and there are evaporation sprayers in the pits. In other words, it's sprayed up into the air in the sunlight so that it can evaporate faster. This is one of the really, truly insane methods of water disposal. And I think also, and at least in my travels, several instances of this illegal dumping. Frack fluid is drizzled out onto roads, dumped into streams, and we have somebody who hands me a jar of this produced water. It's actually called produced water when it comes out of the well. So I get a jar of this material. We have it analyzed. This process creates so much, so many toxins, both in the air, what's left in the ground, in the groundwater, and the waste products, that it's truly a mystery as to where it is all ending up. And we don't have adequate regulation at the state level to really look into all of this.
We're going to look at one state, New York, that's trying to change that. But meanwhile, the people you meet say the gas is in their well water. You start in Dimock, Pennsylvania, where you meet people who've been sick, their animals are sick and losing hair. You say Pennsylvania did order Cabot Oil and Gas to suspend some natural gas drilling to address contamination. There were some fines levied, but the drilling is still going on. You then begin traveling across the country and meet a lot of people who can light their water on fire?
Well, when I first got to Dimock, I heard reports that people could light their water on fire. And of course, as an investigator and a documentarian, I wanted, and as a person, I really wanted to see this. Like, how could you light water on fire? What had happened in Dimock is nobody could do it because the gas company had swept in, disconnected everybody's water supply, which is a kind of a good idea because your house can explode if your water is flammable, and then given them cisterns, replacement water. And this is a phenomenon that I heard of a lot, that once you had flammable water, the gas company would come in, disconnect the water supply, give you replacement water, and often in an exchange for a non-disclosure agreement. In other words, the people were silenced. They weren't able to go to the media. They weren't able to talk to their friends about what had happened if they wanted to continue to receive replacement water. And these people are basically backed into a corner because once you have contaminated water, you can't sell your house. You have lost all the equity in your house, and so you're trapped there.
But you did, in fact, find people who could still light up their water, and not just faucets, but there's video of a man, you know, doing this over a bubbling stream that's been polluted by this gas. What's that like?
It's really surreal. You know, we heard reports of it in Colorado, Wyoming, Texas, Louisiana, as far as Australia, where they're doing a lot of hydraulic fracturing. But, you know, nothing quite prepares you for this moment where, the match, the cigarette lighter or whatever goes underneath the faucet, and then you have this explosion of flame. It kind of turns your brain kind of melts in a weird way. And the first thing that you do is you laugh. Then all of a sudden it hits you. It's like you're getting punched in the stomach. You've got to wonder, what is going on under the ground that is making this happen?
Well, and as a viewer, you're thinking, go to your government officials. And you meet a woman who did. This is Renee McClure. She and her kids are sick. They have headaches. You're reading her a report of what was found in her drinking water at this point, and here's your exchange.
It says here you have trichlorobenzene in the water.
And what is that?
It's one of the volatile organic compounds that comes up with the production of the gas.
What blows my mind is that the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, I thought they were there to work for the people. They're not there to work for the people. They are there to work and help the oil and gas companies. And I asked him, who's there for the people? And he told me, nobody, call an attorney. That's what they told me.
Renee McClure of Colorado in the HBO film Gasland. We'll have much more after a break, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with filmmaker Josh Fox. He lives in Pennsylvania on top of what's known as the Marcellus Shale, a massive expanse of a rock formation that Josh calls the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. One day, Josh got a letter from a mining company seeking to lease his land to drill for natural gas on his property. He didn't agree. Instead, he ended up making a film about drilling for natural gas. It's called Gasland. It begins airing tonight on HBO. Now, Josh met people across the country whose water was undrinkable, some of it flammable, because of a drilling technique known as fracking. It uses lots of water and chemicals to extract the gas, but it leaves a lot of that water and chemicals behind in the ground where it interacts with well water. It's also brought up into holding tanks where it evaporates into the air. Josh also met a whistleblower, Weston Wilson of the Environmental Protection Agency, who explains that it was the Energy Policy Act of 2005, shaped by Dick Cheney's office during the Bush administration, that changed the EPA. It switched the burden from companies to people to prove that the industry was polluting. Let's listen.
You're saying it's the industry itself should be proving it and not the people.
This is America. We shouldn't be assuming that corporation can keep a secret, especially when they're practicing in our backyard. So the onus should be on the industry to prove to the government that their practice is benign and not that assumption. What you could be picking up from these citizens is what we should be investigating, but we're not. We're still asleep at the wheel.
So, Josh Fox, bring us up to date, because you did meet lawmakers in New York, in fact, who were outraged by this. You met people, you know, trying to pass legislation that would at least make the oil industry disclose chemicals in the fracking water. Bring us up to date.
At the federal level, there is an act now being proposed by Maurice Hinchey and Diana DeGette called the FRAC Act. The FRAC Act would re-regulate the industry under the Safe Drinking Water Act. It's facing a lot of opposition. It's facing lobbying by the industry. In New York State, there are two moratorium bills that are on the floor of the state legislature, and it's unclear whether or not they're going to pass. But even the fact that there are these two bills, one's a two-year moratorium, another one's a one-year moratorium, is stating that a lot of people in the state government are looking at this gas drilling industry going, we have no confidence in what you're saying to us. We won't allow this in New York State until we have an investigation on the subject, and that's actually a good sign. The bad sign is that so much of this practice is going on right now across Pennsylvania. They're permitting like crazy. We have this throughout the West. We have it in West Virginia, Ohio. I mean, this drilling campaign is in 34 states. We're in the largest domestic natural gas drilling campaign in history. And the other thing that's unfortunate is that right now, people like T. Boone Pickens are going out there and saying natural gas is the solution to the oil spill.
Well, we all, you know, in the office, everyone thinks, oh, that's the clean energy.
Oh, well, this is, yeah, well, that's because there's this enormous PR campaign on behalf of natural gas. Natural gas actually pollutes the air as much as coal. When you take the whole life cycle of drilling for natural gas, and as you see in the film, in the process of drilling, they vent off enormous amounts of this natural gas into the atmosphere. And methane is 25 times the greenhouse gas of carbon dioxide, so carbon 25 times more potent. So when they release that into the air through the venting of the pipelines, through the condensate tanks that boil over, through the rigs themselves, you're actually on a par with coal. It's very deceiving to say that it's cleaner burning than coal. Sure, when you burn it, it is. But if you take the whole life cycle together, it's rather shocking. And then when you look at it from the standpoint of climate change, it makes no difference whether you're using coal or natural gas. And what I'm interested in looking at in the future is renewable energy. Renewable energy right now.
Yeah,
I mean, we have the technology to do that.
But Josh, as you know, and you speak to people in the film, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's just, you know,
sure.
You speak with kind of hapless government officials who kind of say, hey, what am I supposed to do? They literally say to you, what do you want me to do? We need energy, and it just isn't up to speed right now. Not solar, not wind. It's just not in position to take the place of all the demand.
But it is up to speed. It's a matter of political will. We were promised a smart grid when Obama campaigned. We were promised a green economy. We have to move on that with speed. I still have to believe when I get up every morning that I'm living in America, that power comes from the bottom up, and that if people demand these things, the change will come. We could get our electricity grid off of fossil fuels in 10 years. We have to work in that direction, or else we're putting our onshore water supplies, our safe drinking, our drinking water supplies at risk. And certainly, if what's happening in the Gulf is any indication of what can happen when you have extractive energy industries that are unregulated, that are cutting corners, that are not forced to comply, you know, with our basic environmental laws, you know, you can see what disaster has happened, and it's absolutely tragic. And I'm hoping that, you know, we can stop this practice of hydraulic fracturing in America. What I'm seeing out there from people and what I'm hearing is that their lives have been ruined by this, and that they're very, very, very worried about our drinking water supplies.
Well, just a couple last things, Josh. First of all, you have the industry speak for itself in the film. You show a hearing in which several industry heads line up and say there is absolutely no problem. Let's listen.
In recent months, the states have become aware of press reports and websites alleging that six states have documented over 1,000 incidents of groundwater contamination resulting from the practice of hydraulic fracturing. Such reports are not accurate.
Studies and surveys by GWPC, EPA, and IOGCC over the last 11 years have found no real credible threat to underground drinking water from hydraulic fracturing.
And Josh, here was my question. Where were all these people you met? Why aren't these people who you can see who are sick and are lighting their faucets on fire and their animals are dying? And why don't we know about this?
You know, I think for a long time it was happening in the Rocky Mountain West, where there are very few people. and there's not a lot of media attention. I think we're hearing a lot more about this story now that it's coming to the east, and those watersheds, which supply 15.6 million people with water. You know, out west, it's much more prevalent, the knowledge of hydraulic fracturing. And they said to me, my subjects out west, and it was really moving, they said, look, it's too late for us. You have to get this to people who don't know about this.
That's Josh Fox. His film about the natural gas drilling technique, hydraulic fracturing or fracking, is called Gasland. It won the Documentary Special Jury Prize at the 2010 Sundance Film Festival. It begins airing tonight on HBO. We'll link you to his website at ours, hereandnow.org. Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Extra police will be on hand in Fremont, Nebraska today, where at least half the registered voters are expected to turn out for a hot-button special election that asks these questions. Should it be illegal for local businesses to hire illegal immigrants? And should it be against the law for local landlords to rent to them? About 2,000 Hispanics now live in Fremont. That's up from 300 or so in the 1990s. And the town has seen an influx of illegal immigrants hired to work in meatpacking factories. Fred Knapp is a reporter for Nebraska's NPR station, NET Radio. So, Fred, what's been the impact of today's vote? Is there a lot of tension around it?
There is. People are concerned about whether Hispanics would feel welcome. You mentioned some of the statistics, but the vast majority of those folks are probably legal residents or even U.S. citizens. And on the other side, there are people who are frustrated with change in the town.
Well, and you spoke with one of those residents, John Wiegert, who says he feels illegal immigrants are costing Fremont money from schools to courts to hospitals, but also
crime has gone up. There is definitely gangs in town. You read about it in the paper. There's a lot of criminals.
But then, Fred Knapp, you also spoke with Kristen Ostrom. She's with the group One Fremont, One Future. She's opposed to this measure, which again will put a ban on hiring illegal immigrants or renting to them.
There's a small group of Hispanics here. Almost 8% of our community are Hispanics. Majority of those people are citizens, U.S. citizens.
Well, and Fred Knapp, the Fremont Chamber of Commerce agrees with her. They recently passed a resolution opposing the ordinance that's being voted on today. What's their thinking?
Well, I think a lot of people are concerned about what this would do to the business climate in the town and also the costs of defending against expected legal action should the measure pass.
Yeah, well, the Omaha World-Herald reported yesterday that at least 40 cities across the country have tried similar measures. The two that passed, one in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, another in Farmers Branch, Texas, have yet to be enforced because of these legal challenges, which are costing them millions. Another town, Valley Park, Missouri, dropped the housing restrictions from their ordinance because lower courts found it unconstitutional. So is Fremont prepared to make these challenges in court should this ban pass?
Well, they're going to have to defend the law if it passes, and the ACLU has threatened to sue them, and so they're not looking forward to the cost of defending it.
Well, meanwhile, are legal immigrants leaving? You spoke with Leslie Velez. She's a college student. Her dad runs an Hispanic grocery store. She says Hispanic residents are concerned.
They don't understand what the law actually means, so they all just assume that they're going to get kicked out, all the Hispanics, even citizens. So everybody's kind of scared about it. Everybody just trying to stay home, maybe, like not go out as much anymore.
So, Fred, are legal Hispanics leaving?
Well, I think that they're not leaving yet, but they're certainly concerned about the atmosphere. And I think Leslie's quote also points out the sort of symbolic nature of this, because it would only apply within Fremont city limits, whereas the meatpacking plants and many of the trailer courts where immigrant workers live are outside the city limits.
Well, so it sounds as if this law wouldn't even apply to the employers of these meatpacking plants, again, outside Fremont city limits and bringing in most of the immigrants to work in the plant. They also have the federal government's E-Verify employment eligibility verification system, which employers can use to see if potential employees are in the country legally. But that's a volunteer program. But as you said, it's sort of moot because this law doesn't apply to the plant. So what's the thinking? Is it more of a scare tactic?
Well, it's a tactic to put the city of Fremont on record as to where it wants to be. And the thinking is that if Fremont adopts it, then perhaps the surrounding
That's Fred Knapp, a reporter with Nebraska's NPR station NET Radio. As the town of Fremont, Nebraska, votes today on an ordinance that would ban the hiring of and renting apartments to illegal immigrants. Fred, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, a quick heads up. Tomorrow on Here and Now, with home repossessions at record levels, we'll look at an innovative program here in Massachusetts that helps homeowners who've lost their homes to foreclosure buy them back. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, why is HIV transmission from mother to child so high in the developing world? That's in 30 seconds, Here and Now. The leading cause of HIV infection in children is transmission from a mother to a child. In the developing world, an estimated 900 children a day are born with HIV. And in 2001, a number of governments made a commitment to reduce mother-to-child transmission by half by 2010. Well, our next guest says that hasn't happened, that as developed countries like the U.S. have brought levels down close to zero, in the developing world, transmission rates are still high. And in addition, the treatment that keeps the child from getting HIV may actually harm the mother, potentially leaving the baby motherless. Let's hear more. Paula Donovan is co-executive director of AIDS Free World, an international advocacy organization. Paula, as we said, in the U.S., it's rare that a pregnant woman passes HIV to her child because in the U.S., HIV-positive moms are given a number of different antiretroviral drugs throughout their pregnancy and their delivery. So what happens in the developing world? What happens to moms who are pregnant and HIV-positive?
In most developing countries at the moment, mothers who are pregnant receive one drug. It's called nevirapine. It's a terrific drug. It's really important in the fight against HIV. It's a component of the three-drug cocktail that people all over the world take. But when it's given to mothers to prevent transmission of HIV, it's given just one dose, just as labor begins. And then the infant, right after birth, within the first 72 hours, is given one dose. And while that can cut the transmission of HIV to the infant, it does something really dreadful for the mother. It creates resistance to nevirapine, so that later in the mother's progression from HIV to AIDS, when she needs to go on that three-drug cocktail, she's now resistant to one of the three components of that cocktail.
It would be like someone who is ill taking just one antibiotic out of a regimen of maybe 50. And so you may get some help initially, but then your body builds up a defense against the antibiotic.
That's right, if you don't take it in combination with the other drugs,
right.
Yeah.
This idea that there's a downside to AIDS treatment has been hard to grasp. I mean, as you said, the nevirapine does work in many cases in cutting the transmission to the child.
That's right.
So people thought, well, that voila. And I remember I became aware of this because the Rotary Club of Los Altos, California, which is a real leader in AIDS awareness, they wanted to launch a campaign, one dose, one child. You know, the idea that, hey, they just need this one dose when they're born of nevirapine, and you can save a child's life. But your group explained to them, no, we need to think more broadly about saving the mother, too.
That's right. And I remember in 2000 when the drug manufacturer that makes nevirapine offered it for free to any developing country that could use it, we all thought it was a miracle drug. What we learned afterwards was that this resistant strain is likely in several cases. But the other part of it is that in the years since 2000, the availability of antiretroviral drugs for the world has become exponentially greater. The prices have gone down, and it is possible now to put all the world that has HIV on antiretroviral drugs. And that's what governments committed to most recently. The goal of universal access to treatment was agreed universally by the member states of the UN.
But this call from you and others and governments to think of the mother as also worth saving comes exactly at a time when we hear that, especially in Africa, people are cutting back on AIDS funding, that philanthropists, for instance, are looking more at malaria treatment and shifting their focus from AIDS.
That's right. It's the classic, you know, assume that it's a pie of a particular size and it needs to be divided up differently according to whatever the priority is of the day. And if there isn't enough money, you shift resources from one spot to another, which is just crazy. I mean, we now have the wherewithal. We know exactly what to do when someone contracts HIV. So there is absolutely no reason for this false division in the world, that if you happen to be born in a poor country, you get something that is, you know, substandard and puts your life at risk. And if you happen to be born in a wealthy country, you're entitled to the very best.
Who pays for it, though, in African countries? If maybe insurance companies and people themselves pay for it here, who would pay for it?
Well, governments have the primary responsibility. I mean, it's in the interest of everyone around the world to stop the AIDS pandemic. And so if the governments in a particular country just can't afford it, then it's the responsibility of all the world.
Touch on the controversy around breastfeeding. Because if a child doesn't contract HIV during delivery, he or she is still vulnerable during breastfeeding. Explain why.
It's a strange situation of a little bit of breastfeeding can be deadly, and a lot of breastfeeding can save the baby's life. So the problem occurs for babies who are born to HIV-positive mothers when they get a combination of breast milk, which is tainted, but which can flow through the baby's system without really imperiling the infant, just so long as there are no tiny tears in the baby's gut. Mm. Now, the thing that causes those tiny tears is introducing into a tiny infant's system something other than mother's milk. Then the baby can develop very easily some tiny, almost like ulcers, and through those openings, then HIV-tainted breast milk can get into the infant's system. The baby is then in danger of contracting HIV. So by exclusively breastfeeding their babies, mothers who are HIV-positive mothers all over the world are actually giving their babies all kinds of other immunities to other diseases that might claim the life of a baby, even if it does escape HIV.
I want to ask you, you just returned from Africa, and I want to ask you about the impact of a transmission of HIV through rape and rape as a political tool. Mm-hmm. And you saw the consequences of that in Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe.
We just completed a report called Electing to Rape, and it's a compilation of the affidavits of 70 women who were raped as part of an orchestrated campaign by Robert Mugabe to retain power. Mugabe and his henchmen found that a really effective way to control populations is to target particular women who were part of the opposition party. They had their names and addresses, and they would go to their homes and, in most cases, drag them away to a base camp and rape them over the course of 1 to 3 days. And they would say, go back to your family and let them know exactly who they should and shouldn't vote for. And this is something that we're seeing in countries all over the world.
Is it spreading HIV?
Yes, it spreads HIV. And this is, in some instances, actually willful on the part of the perpetrators. They say, I am teaching you a lesson and I'm passing along a virus to you. In some cases, some of the women told us that they had heard those words and were additionally terrorized.
That's Paula Donovan. She's co-executive director of AIDS Free World, an international advocacy organization. Paula, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. That's the song Only Love from the new CD, Grace Potter and the Nocturnals, Grace Potter being the lead singer and the leader of this Waitsfield, Vermont-based band. Rolling Stone says it's one of the hottest new bands of the year, and they describe Grace as a modern New England blues mama. Well, wonder what she thinks that means. Grace Potter joins us from NPR in New York. Grace, welcome.
How you doing?
A blues mama?
I don't know, man. Whatever. Press is going to say what press is going to say, and I'm flattered that Rolling Stone is even printing anything about me. But, you know, I don't have any kids.
When I think blues mama, I think Janis Joplin. I'm just wondering, who did you admire growing up in Vermont? And if you wanted to be compared to somebody, who would it be?
I think I'm inspired more by Jethro Tull, Spooky Tooth, The Who, Led Zeppelin. I loved The Pentangle and Steel Eye Span. And Richard Thompson, and I kind of delved deep into the British thing, so I don't know where the Janis thing comes
fits.
From. I think people just see a girl with long brownish blonde hair, and they just put it together.
Right.
Like that.
Well, and I'm thinking too that it sounds like you were inspired by the music that your parents listened to. And when we say you live up in Vermont, you live still with them and your boyfriend.
I do.
Tell us about them.
Well, my folks raised me as a humble, hardworking kid. There was never a dull moment at the Potter House, and my dad is such a creative force. Sparky is his name. And, you know, if we wanted to watch a movie, we were required to be painting something, doing something at all times, even when sitting in front of, you know, Ghostbusters or Willow or something.
And your dad is a sculptor? He works with wood? Or
he's a sign maker.
And your mom makes wooden bowls, which if you don't have a wooden bowl from Vermont, what is wrong with you?
Peggy Potter's hand-painted wooden bowls. And so, you know, the arts and the creative side of my family was always, it ran very deep and was sort of intrinsic in any Potter child.
Well, and it came through the music in you. I just want to listen. This is not on the new CD, but it's on another that people may be very familiar with. It's the CD Almost Alice that was a companion to Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland movie. You did White Rabbit by the Jefferson Airplane. Let's listen. So again, this music that seemed to come through your parents, Grace Potter, through you, but they also make no bones about the fact that they're sort of, you know, they're still Vermont hippies.
Right.
No secret, they did drugs. How is
oh,
that?
Yeah.
What's it like to move back, to be living with them?
I mean, they're my peers. I mean, they're my parents first and foremost, but they influenced so much of what made me who I am and also what I want to continue to be. And I use them as a deep influence, and it really keeps me grounded. You know, there's no amount of fancy hanging out on the Sunset Strip and partying until 5 a.m. is going to change who I am, because I always come back to my family.
And what about the influence, not just of your parents, but of Vermont? It's such a beautiful place, hard to put into words. Is it in the songs?
It's in every song, because being a Vermonter, there's the whole do-it-yourself mentality, which is why people move to Vermont from other places. And Vermonters themselves, even if they're fifth, sixth, seventh generation, I mean, you look at some of these family farms that have been there for generations, and people are still waking up at 4:30 in the morning to make ends meet.
Pick one song that where that really comes through.
Things I Never Needed is a song that brings about that kind of sense of not actually needing the things that surround you, that you think define you. If you strip that all away, you're still you at the core, and you need to, you know, face the music. Take a long, hard look at my face. Take away the things I can't replace. Take my heart, go on, take it away. I've got nothing to say.
I'm thinking of my cousins, the Lions, outside, you know, Middlebury, Vermont. You know, she doesn't just make the pot holder, she makes the pot. You know, just...
I love it.
Yeah, what you need. You have what you need. Let's listen to another one of the songs. By the way, do you write them all?
I really spent the first 7 years of this band trying to establish the fact that I was writing the songs and mine, you know. But then I realized, like, you know, my band is my family and they know me better than anybody. And if they want to write a song with me, like the song Medicine, hey, man, let's do it.
That's Grace Potter of Grace Potter and the Nocturnals singing Medicine off the new CD, Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. Grace Potter, just want to swing you back actually to a song that you wrote, which was called Colors. And I understand this had something to do with watching television the day Barack Obama was elected president.
That's right. Yeah, we were in St. Louis, Missouri. We watched the map turn blue and red, and I thought that was a compelling topic for a song. I thought, you know, that sort of elasticity and that moment, that frozen moment in time when no one knew what was going to happen, and there was so much hope and so much fear, and you know, it was just so crystallized in my memory, and I wanted to write a song to capture that before it went away. This is the greatest time of
Chase Potter, one last question before we let you go. And again, you're touring with your band, but home is the home you grew up in with your parents up there in Vermont. And we understand you've had one of the highest accolades possible, we think, which is that you have your own candy bar.
No, I know. It's so exciting. It's great. Lake Champlain Chocolates is, you know, one of those insanely awesome, exquisite companies that just turns out, fair trade, really well-made, delicious chocolate. And
based in Vermont.
And it was actually Matt Burr, our drummer, who had this sort of masterminded idea to collaborate with a company and bring about a flavor that had never been done before. He presented it to them. I came in. I'm a big foodie, so I got real serious about the flavors and finally settled on pistachio red pepper flake with a dark chocolate core. And it's one of the most amazing, flavor experiences of my life.
Boy, is Nico Case jealous?
Apparently she lives in Vermont, but I haven't seen her up there at all. She moved up to Vermont, apparently.
Well, we think you two should get together. You're the new genre of musicians, fabulous women musicians from Vermont. That's Grace Potter of Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
And as we all fall down, it's hard to see.
And you can see a video of this song. It's called Tiny Light at our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what the week brings here and now.
This house of stone has crumbled from the inside.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.